Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school.
Welcome, everyone, to today's episode. Alex, how are you doing today?
Doing pretty well. Just hanging out here with my daughter, Ava, on a beautiful day. It's like 70 degrees.
Ava is like our third co-host, basically. She's here.
Well,
I love when Ava
interjects input things. whenever you do. What about yourself? How are you doing?
My shoulder hurts a lot. I've no idea why. I think it's because I'm getting old, but you know,
lifting, getting swole.
I'm not. That's a problem.
So that's like the most common CrossFit injury.
I'm like, not even doing CrossFit.
He's doing a muscle up.
You should.
I guess so.
Then you'll have an excuse for the shoulder injury. People are like, why are you hurt? You'll be like, I do CrossFit.
Yeah, I guess I should.
People are calling it now because I guess the CEO got fired for being like, he had some racist tweets going out like back in my...
It's never a good idea if you run a business.
To be a racist?
Well, I don't know.
Our guest today is dropping some wisdom early on for us, and I love it. So today we're talking about one type of job transition that could happen to some people, which is from private to academia. And our guest is Benjamin Hansen. He is the W.E. Minor Professor of Economics at the University of Oregon. He's an applied microeconomist whose research focuses on crime, health, and other topics in labor and public economics. He's also the director of graduate studies. So people who are looking into getting into the PhD program, Ben would be a great person to know and contact. Ben, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit of a fun fact about yourself so people can get to know you better.
Yeah. So I guess in a previous life as an undergraduate, I was the lead singer and guitarist for a couple different punk rock bands.
What? Yes. I did not know that. That's so cool. Okay.
Were there any amazing names?
The last band I was in was called Mullets and Bullets.
I would go see I'd buy the album.
That is hilarious.
It sounds great.
Yeah. So if I tilt this over here, you can even see a couple guitars hanging on.
Oh, yeah.
That is phenomenal.
Do you still sing?
In my car.
And do you have like the Blink-182 voice, or you have a different kind of voice?
I would say somewhere between a Tom DeLonge, like Blink-182, and a Billy Joe. Like, okay. You know, I carry a tune a little bit better than Tom.
Okay.
Tom DeLonge amazes me, by the way. Just he basically got pushed forward that whole UFO agenda.
If
you don't know about Tom DeLonge and aliens, you should Google it.
Oh no, the unidentified show on History Channel has been awesome. My wife keeps giving me crap about it, but like whenever it's on, like I'm like down there watching Unidentified and I'm like, see, aliens are real.
Yes, I love it. Yeah. All right. So I think this is a great place to pause and sort of shift gears a little bit. And we like to begin before we sort of get into the topic of the day, just hearing a little bit about some project you want to plug or research you're working on. So Ben, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us, you know, just a minute or two about something you're excited about.
Yeah. So right now I'm just pushing a project towards the finish line with a couple of great co-authors, Aaron Chalfin, Emily Weisburst, and Morgan Williams. We're working on a project that investigates the effect that police employment has, or like police staffing levels on homicides. And this is a question people have looked at before, but we're the first one that has separated it out by Black and white homicides. So we're seeing when there's more police or fewer police, how does that affect race-specific homicide? So we're using the supplemental homicide report data. We are using some data that are fairly new to also see what happens to police shootings. So a lot of this is combining together approaches that people have been used before and data sets that are out there. but disaggregating some outcomes that I think are super important right now for policy, you know?
And so is the race disaggregation happening at the homicide or the police officer race?
So where it's happening at the homicide level. So we don't know if this is, you know, the hiring of black police or white police. This is just, if there's more or fewer police, what is happening to white and black homicide victimization rates? And we all split it out by gender and by age as well. And generally we find when there's more police, there's fewer black homicides and there's fewer white homicides. We find that there aren't really large effects on clearance rates, suggesting this is probably more driven by a deterrence effect of more police being around. But we do find that there are large increases in low-level arrests for misdemeanor crimes. So imagine like marijuana possession, you know, drunk in public, disorderly conduct, that sort of things. And that these increases in low-level arrests are much larger for young black males than they are for young white males.
I see. Wow. That sounds A, really interesting. B, I'm sure you're going to get a lot of questions about all of that.
It might turn out that everybody hates us because, you know, there is some evidence here that the when more police are hired, that this that minority communities do experience over policing, you know, disproportionately, that they're more likely to be arrested for these low level crimes. But it's also true if you were to just massively reduce the number of police, you know, ceteris paribus, that would result likely in an increase in homicides, and that young black men would bear the brunt of that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like it's a complicated set of facts, right? As true stuff normally is, right? Rather than a simple one side or the other. So that's really interesting.
I obviously have a lot more questions, but unfortunately or fortunately, this is not a research podcast. Shout out to Problem Causation. I know Jen has her podcast more focused on research and papers, and so that's great. But this is a great place to pause and kind of transition to our topic of the day. So Ben, let's start at the beginning, and maybe can you tell us a bit about your career path at the end of graduate school, or maybe even before, like, what made you go to grad school? And then after that, you were like, you know, where did life take you?
Yeah, sure. So when I was an undergraduate studying economics, I had a professor that I really liked and connected with. And oddly enough, he was actually kind of a part-time adjunct professor. Yeah, he worked full-time at LECG, a consulting company, and then taught intermediate micro every once in a while, just because he felt like it both helped his public speaking and he just liked being in the classroom. So he was there teaching and, you know, I was taking some economics classes, but at the time I was, I think, majoring in econ and planning to go to law school. And during one lecture, he was trying to convince everybody why he got a PhD. And he said it was the best choice he made because it let him delay growing up. And I was like, oh, tell me about growing up.
That sounds delightful.
He's like, well, I got to like delay making a choice of what I wanted to do with my life. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that doesn't sound like that much of a hard sell, you know? Mm-hmm. He's like, no, he's like, what I mean by that is name something you're interested in. Pick it, whatever you're interested in. He's like, I guarantee you there's an economist out there that studies it. Okay. And so whatever you're passionate about, this is a really great way for you to develop a tool set to study questions that you think are really interesting. And so you know, this was, of course, a point in my life where I'm like, I think I'm like a junior in college and trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life. And I was like, well, delaying making that choice of pigeonholing myself into a career does sound a bit appealing.
Right.
But then having the flexibility to study whatever I'm interested in, that sounds great. And then I saw, you know, look, there are legitimate private sector jobs that you can get. Working for like litigation consulting companies and other companies, in addition to being in academia. So that for me was, you know, convinced me that this was worth investing, you know, the next, you know, 5 years of my life in doing. So,
Wow, that's super interesting. And do you still keep in contact with that professor?
Yeah. He follows me on Instagram. I follow him. We're also Strava buddies, you know, like,
okay.
Shout out to Strava, right?
Yeah. No, he's Stephen Waters. He's a much better biker than I am. You know, he puts my, like, he puts my times to shame. So,
and remind me, where did you go to undergrad?
I went to BYU.
BYU. Okay. So yeah. You finish college, you apply to grad school, you get into a couple of grad schools, and where do you go?
I went to UCSB.
UCSB. Okay. Oh, I love UCSB. That's great. And then you do the program there, and then you're hitting the job market time. And what's your perception that at around that time? Yeah. Like, okay, I want to get any job or et cetera.
Well, I kind of made like an ordered, you know, ranked list of like the types of jobs I wanted. And it was kind of like, all right, first place I wanted to go was like an R1 research university, you know, and coming out of a place like UCSB, I knew that like Harvard was, you know, never going to hire me, you know, or like, if they were going to, I was going to have to take many like stepping stones to get there. And there's people who have, so I'm not saying it's impossible. Right.
Right.
But
a boy can dream.
Yeah.
Well, or a girl can dream.
And you can dream and work your butt off and make it happen, because nobody's going to make it happen for you. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to be in an R1 research university, or, you know, next on the list, I wanted to be at, you know, probably like a research think tank type job, like a Mathematica, RAND, something like that. Or I wanted to go to like a litigation consulting company maybe after that, like, just because even though, you know, it'd be long hours of work and
ka-ching!
there's the money, right?
Compensating differential.
Yeah, yes. There you go.
Well, and I have some interesting things to say about those jobs and why I actually found a lot of their questions more interesting than I thought it would.
Okay.
But given I was trained in labor economics, it wasn't the labor economics questions that were even interesting. Like their litigation research is actually kind of boring. And boring and also depressing.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Well, half of what they get paid to do is to pre-approve layoff plans by firms.
Oh yeah, that doesn't sound
great. A firm
will
come to you and say, we're going to lay off 50,000 people. Make sure we aren't racist. And here's our data, run the regressions. Make sure when you control for experience and whatever kind of merit system we track internally, that, you know, race and gender stuff doesn't show up in our regression. And So
That's a tough job.
Well, I mean, it's probably important for firms to be self-auditing too. So I'm not saying
that's true. That's a good point.
But it's a weird thing to think that you're going to enrich yourself on other people's like suffering. And I didn't know that I could do that. Mm-hmm. But anyways,
so
litigation consulting jobs. Mm-hmm. And then after that was kind of like the like teaching focused jobs where you just teach like 4-4, 5-5 teaching load and focus on teaching. And that was, it was a job I would have liked. I liked teaching then. I like teaching now. But it's not something I wanted to do full time. You know,
so it was like a motivating thought the whole time. Was it this original sort of impetus to go to grad school? Like, I want to be able to choose my own questions.
So
those are sort of ranked by like how much you have like autonomy in question choice or almost.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. So you went on the market and in the end, did you have a plethora of choices or the market was invisible?
So the market I went on was in, so this was in 2009, fall of 2008 is when I go on the market. So this is like right when the financial crisis hits. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is the most recent time that there was like, I think an unexpectedly bad and different job market than there was in previous years. And, you know, you get out there and you interview for jobs and you, and people will say, yeah, this is a tough market this year. And everyone at the dinner table will tell you how their market was the toughest, you know, but this was like at least the first market that I saw. And I think I've ever seen where the AEA specifically was actually noting which jobs were canceled.
Oh, wow.
Okay. You go down the list of academic jobs and there was just like red X's next to all the jobs.
Wow.
That meant the position had been canceled. And so I think probably during that fall, 30 to 40% of the academic jobs got canceled.
Wow.
And that's on like the extensive margin. There was also intensive margin effects that like jobs previously at a university where they might be, maybe they were going to have 2 or 3 positions, all of a sudden went down to 1. Hmm. So there was a big contraction in academic jobs that was available in that year.
Okay.
There was also a big expansion in government jobs and in private sector jobs and in government contracting jobs, partly related to big fiscal stimulus things that we're going through.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you landed which job?
So I ended up at Impact International,
okay,
which is a research consulting firm in DC. Mm-hmm. And through this process, I actually learned that there's different types of think tanks. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's like the Rand Corporation, which is a nonprofit, but it actually originally kind of developed as an organization that did think tank work for the Army. Mm-hmm. But they're nonprofit. But then there's also other nonprofits like the Urban Institute, mm-hmm. or like Public Policy Institute of California that are nonprofits that are mostly interested in policy work. They might put out white papers, you know, they're trying, mm-hmm. and like the Urban Institute is trying to put out stuff that's like super responsive to the question.
I love their work.
Mm-hmm. You know, same thing like Brookings, right? Versus like an Impact International, a Mathematica, a CNA Corp, you know, Apt Associates, those were all for-profit research firms. Mm. So they actually, like, the company has an owner or a set of owners, right. And they're trying to make profit. But what they do is they respond to requests for proposals that the government puts out. Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, bid on these contracts, and they bid on the contract, sometimes partnering up with other small businesses. Sometimes they'll partner with each other, and then they get the projects, and then they do the research. Right. And mm-hmm. Takes them anywhere from, you know, a couple months to 5 years to deliver the research to their government partner.
Which I think it's like well, at least when I was in the market, I saw it as like the positive thing in the sense that you're doing work that is actually going to be used by the agencies that are like requesting it, at least. And that felt really important. And as opposed to me writing a paper that maybe no one will read. So
and maybe three people.
Yeah.
Like the request for the proposal tells you that the question is important and they care about it.
Right.
So then you might wonder, well, how do I get to be creative in my, like my research or something like that? And there the creativity really can arise in how you answer the question.
That's a really good point.
And so it doesn't mean like if you're like a person that kind of likes the creative parts of like solving problems that's inherently involved in research that you won't get to be creative. Mm-hmm. No, you're going to have to think creatively about, you know, especially as you rise up in an organization, you become a manager, you might think, well, what set of organizations would be competitive for this? You know, mm-hmm. might not just be you. How do you bring your team together? How do you answer it? You know, and
yeah.
And so I think that there still is a lot to be said, even when you've said, this is the question,
right?
How you answer it can vary. Yeah. There was a lot I liked about the job in terms of real world policy analysis. I got to meet with like, you know, the, you know, Secretary of Labor and
mm-hmm. Wow.
We interacted with like some of the councils of economic advisors, like mm-hmm. Alex Moss and Jesse Rothstein were coming up with these different evaluations that they wanted us mm-hmm. to do that we ended up winning some contracts for. So it was a really good experience in a lot of ways, both for me understanding how research is done in mm-hmm. like in the governmental world and mm-hmm. just thinking about research.
There's eventually a shift in which you're like, okay, I'm going to go in the market again and try something else. And so maybe talk us about made that decision and then what did you do to transition?
So I talked to my advisor about it. And before I left, Peter Kuhn, and he said, look, the longer you're going to be out, the less they're going to treat you like a new incoming assistant professor. And they're just going to expect you to have a lot more publications. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you've been out 5 or 6 years, they're going to expect you to be an associate professor. Mm. If you've only been out 1 year or 2 years, maybe they'll just say, oh, we'll just pretend this was a postdoc. Or we'll treat it as if you're at a postdoc. And that's kind of what I thought of this as, is like, look, this could be my future career. I also could just treat this as like a well-paid postdoc in DC. Mm-hmm. But to that end, I worked kind of evenings working on trying to get my dissertation and other projects out there and submitted a bunch of stuff that spring as I was finishing my dissertation. Mm. And I connected with people that I had actually met on the job market, even though I didn't get the job. Mm. So like at UC Denver, I didn't get hired. Instead, they hired Hani Mansour, who's like completely awesome. So I don't blame him.
You know? Yeah, I was going to say that. Turned out to be a great hire. Yeah.
Well, and I knew Hani from grad school too. And like he was doing great stuff. He totally deserved to get the job, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But Dan Reese and I connected at dinner just about research and questions. So I reached out to him afterwards, and he thought, well, who's this like gutsy, you know, PhD telling me about research, you know,
yeah, hire him.
Yeah, that sounds fun. So me and Dan got started on some projects, and he ended up roping me in on some stuff with
Okay.
And so that helped me to stay connected to some academic circles and to start to develop and craft new relationships and continue that informal networking process that's kind of a part of academia.
Well, that's good to know that you thought about this as you were doing it and you put a lot of effort into it, right? I think sometimes people tend to think, oh, when people switch jobs or this, like maybe it's something like opportunity fell into their lap, but you were out there like moving and shaking and doing a lot of work to make this
happen. Well, and it was something I knew I kind of had a limited time window if I was going to make this transition to really make it happen, that I gave myself like 2 years, maybe three for it to happen. And at the time I even had, when I was choosing between different firms in DC, I could have gone to Apt Associates. I could have gone to CNA Corp. I ended up going to Impact, even though they were kind of the smallest and least well-known, because they had some contracts to do a bunch of independent research on the UI system.
Oh, wow.
And they had some contracts to do some work on this growing America through entrepreneurship program. And so I thought, okay, this place is newer. It's more of a startup. So you have a lot more control of what projects you get put on versus like going to an Apt Associates or a Mathematica. Everything is kind of already siloed off. And so you have very little control of what projects you get put on. You just kind of get a boss or manager that's directly over you and kind of like mentors you as you just kind of progress out. Mm-hmm.
Two quick questions. So how long were you in Impact until you moved?
So I started Impact in July and I was at Oregon by the next July.
So that fall you decided to go into the market basically.
Yes.
Okay.
So, wow. And part of it was like, I had submitted some papers and I got some R&Rs over the summer. So that's where I was working hard and I had a bit of luck. Right. Okay. And I was like, look, these are some additional signals I didn't have on the first time in the market. So I think that's going to help me.
And in the context of your personal life, did you have a family already by then or you were solo? Okay.
So I had a family. So I was married and we had two kids, one of which had been born in June of 2009, right before we moved out to DC.
Oh, wow.
But our kids were pretty young. So like we weren't going to be like pegged down.
Right.
But I did like my job.
Right.
And it was a full-time job. So I couldn't do like your typical search. So I didn't apply to, I think the first time I was on the market, I applied to 140 jobs or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
this time I was on the market, I applied to, I think, 10.
Right. And so I'm just trying to paint a picture here. How much of the time not spent at work stuff did you have to do extra? Like, did you have to work a lot after work or in the weekends or all of that you were able to do it within the work time?
No, I did stuff, you know, on the nights. I did some stuff on weekends, you know. I was able to do some stuff during work time because they had given me like, I think 20% of my time during the first year I could use for my own research. So I basically had one day a week, you know, that I could carve off that I didn't have to like build to projects. Cause that's part of like the research, like consulting world is that it's all about billable hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have a bit of time, but there was definitely a lot of, you know, work in the evenings, you know, after the kids were asleep, there was some work on the weekends. And that was both taking projects that had started in grad school and making sure they were progressing. Mm-hmm. And then it was also starting and continuing these new projects up with people I'd met on the job market with, you know, specifically getting some stuff rolling with Dan Reese and Joe Savia.
Great. And one last question maybe to wrap this part up, which is, so the tips that I'm hearing are, Keep in your academic networks. If you're going to think about transition, don't do it too late. And also be mindful that this is going to cost you a little bit of extra time than the otherwise. Is there something else that you would add?
I'd say start submitting stuff.
Okay.
Right. Like
good advice, no matter what. Right.
Yeah.
Like no guts, no glory. Like send your stuff out and because you need some more signals than what you had before, because it's not like your advisor is going to like carefully look over their letter and be like, oh crap, I accidentally wrote Ben a really bad letter. I need to write him a better one. Right. And that's not going to happen. If anything, your advisor is going to have other students. They're going to be focused on pushing this next year. Mm-hmm. And so for you to, you know, get back into the market, you might need some more signals than what you had, which, you know, you have a year to have stuff under review, mm-hmm. right? That you mm-hmm. didn't have the first time. So if you are continually submitting stuff, your odds of having an R&R, especially if you have multiple projects getting submitted, as long as you're being realistic mm-hmm. and not trying to send everything to, you know, QJE and getting all that to,
right.
to clear. Honestly, you hear back from QJE really quick. So that's not
the other journals, right?
Yeah. That's not the costly one. The costly yeah. one would be sending stuff to, you know, a journal where it sits there for a year.
Right.
Yeah.
And your odds of getting in are really, really low.
Okay. Cool.
So I think being a little bit strategic, if you mm-hmm. want to have that signal, having like the right set of stuff that's higher potential that you are submitting high, but being honest with yourself and maybe submitting some things to, you know, more specialized field journals
right.
can help you to get more signals than you had the first time.
That's great advice. And then I just like more broadly, because now you've hired people, you've obviously made some really good hires at Oregon and you've advised yeah. students.
Spoiler alert, he ended up in Oregon, by the way, at the end of the story. Yeah, I don't know if you caught that.
Cut to the end of the movie.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
But so I often hear from people that like other students when I was on the market, like, don't go into industry. It's a one-way door. Mm. Whereas other people say, no, you can come back and you can move around. To what extent do you think it is true that like if you go into industry, it's more of a terminal state than
yeah.
other positions?
Yeah, I think it probably is. You're probably more likely to stay there. But part of that might just be endogenous to the fact that Impact was a good job.
Fair.
And we were fairly happy there. And
living in a nice place too, I think.
I was living in a nice place. Yeah. And heck, my first year there, they gave me like a 12% raise.
Ooh, that's nice.
Which doesn't happen at state school.
Academia, they don't just come knock on your door and say, hey, your annual raise is 12%. Yeah. If you want to get a raise like that, you either need to get an outside offer or maybe you get it through promotion. Maybe. Right? Like, mm-hmm. And so I think, and that's partly that it is a more competitive market. If you're thinking of like all these research consulting firms, there's in around DC, there's RAND, there's Impact, there's APT, there's Mathematica, right? There's, you can make a list of 6 or 7 firms. And I can tell you, when we were trying to poach people that were more advanced in the industry, they were working locally. Mm. And it wasn't a big deal for them to change what firm they were at.
Right.
Right. Like, they're all living off the red line, you know, in Bethesda. And so
that's right. That's right.
So driving, 10 more minutes to another place, if it gets you a big raise, that's okay. And so it made the labor market a lot more competitive. Whereas, wherever we end up in academia, there's a fair bit of monopsony power.
All right. So a lot of students listen to this podcast and a lot of graduating students. I have this other question, you've had a lot of experience as an advisor. How often do people that know, in sort of quotes, they want to do academia or know that they want to do industry, how often do you think that they're correct in ascribing their own preferences to themselves? Or how often do you think it's like, student underselling themselves or over? I don't even know if that's the right phrase.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I remember a couple of years ago, there was like an Iowa student at the University of Oregon that always told me like he wanted to end up in industry, and now he's teaching at a liberal arts college job and he had the industry offers.
Mm.
Right. So I don't know if that's like, stated preferences just are not revealed preferences, right? There's a mm-hmm. warp, there's not a wasp.
Wait, what does that mean?
There's a weak axiom of revealed preferences.
Oh wow. I thought you were talking about the animals. So I was like, that is an American idiom or something?
No, it's an econometric or a micro theory.
This is incredibly embarrassing. I'm editing it out of the podcast.
Do not. We will know.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's like people just, being a little bit guarded in their own beliefs or self-doubts or, imposter syndrome stuff. And I do think, look, you can have your own preferences and the market will reward different mm-hmm. parts of yourself. And you could have a strong belief or preference you want to end up in academia. But I think there's a certain, set of, personal characteristics combined with what your research paper is that helps you to get through that academic door versus ending up in industry.
Let me ask you one quick question. Is there something that you liked more about industry relative to academia now that you've been in both places?
So industry I already mentioned the like bigger annual raise thing.
Yeah, that's true. Fair enough.
You know, so I think the fact that the labor market is legitimately a lot more competitive, I think is something that's like pretty appealing. At least being at the private in like the contract research like world, the hours were definitely more 9 to 5 there. Mm-hmm. You know, there was like a time of the year where the work followed you home, like during the proposal writing season part of things.
Right.
But not really outside of that.
Yeah, academia does not feel 9 to 5.
No, it does not feel 9 to 5. I try to make it as 9 to 5 as possible, but yeah.
I know. Everyone always like asks if you have summers off, you know, and
yeah, mountain bike all day, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. I know. They look at my Instagram and they're like, "Oh man, you're never working." And I'm like, "Well, I went on that ride at like 6 a.m. Okay.
Yeah. Awesome. So, thank you so much for being with us. So, before we end, we love to end the podcast with a recommendation of the week. This could be anything at all: quote, thought, web page. I don't know, a mountain bike trail near your house. So, like to share your recommendation. Love to hear it.
Let's see. Recommendation is to watch Unidentified and learn the truth about unidentified flying objects in the world.
Oh, make you rethink the original song on the Blink-182 album, Aliens Exist. I thought it was a joke track. Tom DeLonge, he's serious.
No. Yeah. Oh, no, he's completely serious. Yeah.
Is this a Netflix show or what?
History Channel.
Oh, duh. History Channel.
The Fact Channel. Yeah. All right, Sebastian, what do you have today?
So today I'm going to do the following recommendation. I'm going to recommend that as people are, you know, work on their schedules, their usual schedule to work and break and whatever, I actually recommend people scheduling times to talk to people. And this is something that I've been doing for the past few years, and it's great. And that means like I'm going to schedule talk to my mom, talk to my sister, you know, talk to a friend and so on. And the reason why I do this is because if you don't do that, what's going to happen is that people are going to randomly call you, and then you're going to randomly going to answer, and then you're going to have conversations in the middle of maybe your workday or afterwards. And that could be awesome, but at the same time, it could totally like disrupt maybe a cycle that you have. So I like to usually schedule them in my calendar. And that way, you know, I can keep my personal relationships at the same time that I'm keeping my schedule. So that's my recommendation for the
very
week.
Wholesome.
Very wholesome. Thank you. Yeah. Alex, what's yours?
All right. So I'm going to do two, just take priority.
Oh, two for one here.
Two for one.
Our listeners are getting a deal.
The first is, to use Zwift if you have a bike of some sort. So I like to bike, but I don't live near, I live in Indianapolis. It's kind of hard for me to go to a part of the city where it would be easy for me to road bike. So I bought a smart trainer and I use this online application that called Zwift, where I can sort of work out and do all sorts of things on my own. And, you know, like many other people, I've gained the COVID 20, but it would have been the COVID 40 had it not been for Zwift, right? I think it's helpful.
So are you on the economic Strava? Are you on some of their groups? The Real Business Cyclists?
Oh, I did not know about this list.
Yeah, so you can join the Real Business Cyclists. You know, and you can link Zwift over, or you can link Strava also over to a Peloton if you Peloton instead, you know. I also made another group on Strava too called the MBER.
That is solid.
For the Mountain Bike Economist Riders.
I was gonna say, is like only MBER members are allowed.
No. So if you have trouble getting into the MBER, just buy a mountain bike.
Buy a bike, try to hurt yourself on it, and we will welcome you into the MBER.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that.
All right. And awesome. My second one, I'm gonna do it. As we were talking before the podcast, but we didn't record it, about how awesome the Young Applied Micro group is at Oregon. So if you are a prospective PhD student, definitely check out Oregon as a place.
Hashtag ad.
Yeah, for sure. But no, I work with some of the people there, and I know of their work because they have similar fields as me.
I agree.
There's Grant McDermott, Ed Rubin, Eric Zhu, Keaton Miller. There's just so many awesome people. And also they have wonderful resources that teach you how to do econometrics and applied micro online that are freely available. So even if you don't go to Oregon, you can learn from the Oregon faculty.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for joining us today. If people want to find out more about you, where should they go?
Well, first go to my webpage, I guess, and you can see what I've been working on lately. You could go to Twitter, follow me on Ben Konomics. And then if I'm at a conference, just say hi, you know, or send me an email in advance. You know, I've, you know, volunteered before just on Twitter or other stuff to have coffee with whoever at a conference just has a question about like research, academia, whatever. And it's been great to meet a lot of other people. And sometimes you keep in contact, or sometimes it's great to just have a conversation with a stranger, you know? So
yeah. Awesome. Great. So follow Ben on Twitter. Awesome. Thanks for tuning in this week. Please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcast, and see you next week. Bye, everyone.